Müller House Meeting, Monday morning, 16th June 1980. There was a German gentleman who in his young years suffered from serious physical illness, from which he recovered mainly through the strength and purity of his own spirit. He had a good education and obtained a doctor's degree, but being a man of vision, he learned the deep truths of life more through the promptings of his own inner spirit, through the beauty of nature, through his keen observation of human beings and his family life. He grew to quiet greatness as a philosopher of Christian religion, not as a mere academician, for his spiritual vision transcended mere intellectuality, but as an original thinker possessed of deep insight into the art of living humanly. Quite naturally, a band of followers gathered round him. He taught them the beauty and happiness of life in its simplicity and greatness. He was well qualified to show the way of true happiness. Because in addition to happiness in his own life, he had deep suffering, the cruel sorrow of the death of sons in war, the loss of liberty and opportunity to carry on his usual work, and destruction of his property. No one can understand happiness unless he himself has known sorrow. Through his own affliction and through the affliction of all mankind, that distinguished philosopher, destined to be the founder of this famous cultural center of Elmau, situated so appropriately in this valley of peace and beauty, was Johannes Müller, and it is right and proper that we should first pay silent homage to his memory and offer thanks to his children, by whose gracious permission and invitation we are able to hold our meetings in the very room which was Johannes Müller's own study. I have emphasized two words, happiness and suffering, for good reasons. All mankind experiences suffering, and all mankind longs for happiness, longs for eternal happiness. We must emphasize the word eternal in this context. What sort of a creature longs for eternal happiness? a human being. But what is the meaning of the word human? Do we understand what we mean when we say, describe ourselves as human beings? The word itself is derived from the Sanskrit root man, from which our words mind and man in the English language are derived. If you look in the Sanskrit dictionary, you will find that man, the root man, is defined as to think. Now this is an inadequate definition. Our thinking is mainly a string of words silently spoken to ourselves. This sort of thinking is not the thinking which is implied in the profound, ultimate, transcendent meaning of the root word man. The root man actually means creation, to create. You will find, for instance, in Genesis, in the very first chapter, it is said, "And Elohim created," said, "and Elohim said, let us create man in our own living likeness." Now, said again is a very troublesome word in the context, but we being what we are, have no option in the matter but to use such words. If he said, "and Elohim minded, let us create man in our own living likeness," that would be a less misleading translation. But what do we mean by saying Elohim or God minded? What is the mind of God? What is the meaning of the thought of God? If you look deeply into the Hermetic teachings, the Hellenized form of original Egyptian teachings, then you will see that you will find the statement that all father mind created man in his own likeness, with whom he fell in love because he was so beautiful and so like his sire, namely God himself. So now, if we understand the root meaning of man as to create, we'll see that man essentially, fundamentally, transcendentally is a creator. Now, in front of man we have the prefix who, human, we say. Hu in Sanskrit is interchangeable with the Avestan language too. The Avestan language has hu as a prefix, meaning the absolute good, the perfect, and the happy, the blissful. So now, if we take the full meaning in its deepest sense of the word human, we have to say that the word human must mean blissful creator. And whom do we describe as blissful creator? In all the great religions of the world you'll find this. You will find this. But that which we call the supreme being or power or God, whichever word you like to use. So that man is really created in the living likeness of God. He is a blissful creator. And that is the sort of creature who longs, we human beings have that as our potentiality. Obviously we are not that at the moment, but that is our fundamental potentiality. And it is to that towards which the human race is moving in the course of its development through the ages. Bliss immediately links happiness with religion, if we understand human in this sense, and the human being longing for eternal happiness. The word religion today is a word from which the greater part of the human race seems to fight shy, quite unnecessarily. After all, human beings are fundamentally characterized by their religiousness. That's what differentiates them from mosquitoes or ants or dogs or cats or tigers or elephants or even dolphins. I say even dolphins because they are so intelligent. It is our religiousness which differentiates us most and characterizes most as human beings. What is the meaning of the word religion? It is usually derived from the two Latin verbs re legere and re ligare. Cicero, who was a great philosopher, and I think most of you, if not all of you, will probably remember doing Cicero at school, some of his works. I remember in my own days doing Cicero's De Senectute on old age, a marvelous little treatise. Cicero derives religion from re legere, which means to gather together. To gather together, that is religion. And with the idea of gathering together, one can associate the idea of wholeness, of completeness. So Cicero derives it from that. But other thinkers like Servius, Lactantius, and St. Augustine derive the word religion from re ligare, which means to bind back or to fasten. I think this meaning is a little more significant for us and for our purposes. To bind back to what? To bind back ourselves to our transcendent origins, our sources, the fundamental source from which man is derived. The primordial creative energy, that absolute pure consciousness out of which, through the process of differentiation and proliferation, man has ultimately emerged. We, in the course of our emergence, have lost our awareness, our constant total awareness of that transcendent origin. And the purpose of our existence and development is the return to that transcendent source. There is an extraordinarily apt phenomenon in nature which gives us a good correspondence to this process. Here we are surrounded by beautiful mountains which are snow-covered for a good part of the year at least. And from the melting snows, streams go down, rushing downwards, and whither do they go? They go downwards, drawn towards the ocean ultimately. They meet the ocean and make their own contribution to the ocean. Their waters mingle and are united with the ocean. The heat of the sun evaporates the water of the ocean and pours down, and the moisture pours down as rain sometimes, falls as snow at other times. So you get this great round, this process movement from the snows to the sea, then up again from the ocean through the sun's heat, into the shape of clouds and back again onto the mountains. The rains fall and the streams go on, dancing their way towards the sea, their original parent, their original source. So with us human beings too, perhaps it is something like that. So bliss, the idea of bliss, links happiness with religion, and religion, the context of religion is transcendence itself. The state of divine happiness, therefore, the state of the blissful creator, is the state of oneness or of union with and in transcendence, the true or ultimate meditative state, a state of absolute pure consciousness. If you look at one of the very important Indian scriptural writings, the Shandilya Upanishad, you will find that this state of union with transcendence is described as one of pure bliss, of the intensest bliss. So now man's urge, his fundamental urge, whether he is conscious of it or whether he is unconscious of it, by virtue of his very constitution and his origins, is towards eternal happiness. Note, eternal happiness, not transient pleasure. This is a very important point to bear in mind, because we shall have to consider this in a few moments. What is our actual state in the world today? It is not obviously one of eternal happiness. We all know that the world as a whole is in very considerable suffering, difficulty, fear, anxiety, and so forth. We all know the meaning of suffering in ordinary, everyday terms. There is the suffering of millions of people due to hunger. And when we say millions, we literally mean scores of millions of people who suffer from hunger. They suffer from deprivation of all kinds. They suffer from material loss, especially when there are natural calamities like flood, earthquake, or epidemics sweep the land. So there is suffering everywhere, all over the world sometimes, not only in the underdeveloped countries, but in the advanced countries too. There is suffering due to failure in work and in life. This is often our own fault due to our own defects, but often it is due to external circumstances, to misfortune. There is suffering due to anxiety for our own sakes, anxiety for our families, our children, our friends, and so on. There is the suffering which is the result of rejection by one's own family, by friends, by society. There is suffering due to injustice. And this injustice, which not only we suffer, but which others suffer too. There is so much suffering, not only on our own account, but on account of others in the world. And very great suffering due to the fact that we find ourselves utterly helpless to do anything for those who suffer. We are circumstance or our own incapacities prevent us from doing what should be done or what we would like to do to make others happy. There is the suffering due to cruel treatment, physically and mentally, through the imposition of rigid ideologies and so forth. Suffering due to the faithlessness of friends, of life partners, and of those by those whom we trusted. There is also great intellectual distress in our lives. Intellectual distress, especially if we are concerned with answering deep questions. We ask, what is truth? Because if we believe that if we know the truth, we shall be secure, we shall be able to live in the right way, and so forth. And when we are young, we easily are led to believe that such and such is the truth about all things. 10 years later, perhaps, we discover that it is not so true, that something else is the truth. And it is intellectual distress to have one's belief broken down. Then again, another decade later, we discover that, oh no, the previous decade wasn't the final truth. And so we go on decade after decade suffering intellectual distress, that we cannot discover what the truth is. Until we finally do understand that there is no such thing as finality in where truth is concerned. Because truth is so deep, so vast, so beyond our ordinary capacities, the capacities of the brain. And the brain is just the concretest part of the mind. It isn't a whole, pure mind which sees into reality without any delusion or illusion. When we finally discover that our whole life is a process of discovery of truth, continual discovery, and the forms which this truth takes are constantly changing, then the mind is at peace. Until then it is not at peace. It is searching for a truth which is fixed. There is no such thing as a fixed truth, because the moment we formulate the reality, the formulation suffers from our own shortcomings and our own conditioning and so on, and our own mistakes. The absolute truth is that which is actually present in the immediate present. And if we can really look at what is actually present and see it for what it is, then we understand within our limitations and our capacity for formulation the immediate truth as it affects us. And we must be well awake to the fact that this formulation is bound to change as we grow older, as we gather more experience, and perhaps have the good fortune ultimately to experience true revelation. We ask, where is justice? What is freedom? And practically the whole world makes the mistake of defining freedom as doing what we like to do, what we want to do. Freedom begins at the peak point of self-control, of self-restraint. And true self-restraint and control comes only through real self-understanding. Otherwise, it is repression which merely makes us ill. Self-restraint has to be the natural state of the individual when he sees that, this is the right thing, and that is not the best thing at the moment, and be prepared to experience and undergo change as it comes about in the course of his life. So we say that we haven't got freedom. Of course, there are obvious, there is an obvious lack of freedom in so many situations where we are not mistaken in saying that we haven't got freedom. But otherwise, our freedom is mistaken. We mistake license for freedom. Where is peace? Is there peace? It's one of the tragic aspects of world history that hardly a generation throughout the whole of our history knows what it is to be at peace, to be truly secure, to be truly carefree. Like a child feels carefree in its mother's arms. We haven't got that sense of peace. It's only an ominous stillness before the next thunderstorm. Then there is the great search, the great question, who or what is God? And if there is a God, how is it that there is so much evil? How is it that the devil seems to be enjoying life on earth far more than God does? But these are questions which apply not to the mass of human beings, but to the few who have this inner urge to discover for themselves and to grow towards the fulfillment of their own being and towards the fulfillment of the purpose of their existence. Then there is the suffering due to death, the death of a cherished hope, of an exalted ideal, and the death of the dearly loved one, a parent, a child, a very, very dear friend. And the pain of it is due to its inconsolability. Death is so stark, so absolute, it's unanswerable. You can't say no to death, you can't do anything about it. It is there. What we can do is to understand it. But understand it not by rationalizing it, producing intellectual arguments to say that this and so is the situation of the case, and therefore we mustn't grieve. Grief must be there, grief is bound to be there. If grief isn't there, we can never develop true compassion and true sensitivity to the sufferings of others. It is only when one's own heart has suffered, then one is open, one's heart becomes open to all other hearts and all that they go through. There is the suffering due to the conditioned state. No human being escapes this. Not a single one on earth. Not even the perfected holy ones escape this. Because we are all conditioned in some way or other. And gradually our eyes open to our conditioning. And the opening to our conditioning is always accompanied with suffering, inward suffering. But this suffering is a suffering which purifies the whole psyche. And this is essential if we are to fulfill not merely the purpose of our own existence, but fulfill our place as members of a world society, of the whole human race, of mankind. There is, of course, the inevitable suffering which accompanies old age and decrepitude. How many people suffer because of extreme old age and their helplessness? Look at the geriatrics in a geriatric hospital. They are hardly human. They are more like decaying vegetables than human. And so many of them long to die. Because of their condition. there is that suffering in the world too. And there is suffering due to impermanence. Nothing stays put. We believe that security lies in permanence. Permanence doesn't give security. There is no such thing as permanence in the entire universal process. Everything undergoes change. And more often than not, that change is of a nature which we do not want. We would like things to be otherwise. But liking things to be otherwise is not at all wisdom on our part. Because things are what they are, and changes inevitably take place because there is always the resultant of every single force at work. And we can't deal with every single force at work. So there is bound to be impermanence. Impermanence due to accidents, impermanence due to our ignorance, and all sorts of things like that. Now, the suffering due to natural calamities like flood, earthquake, volcanoes, epidemics which sweep over the land, that suffering is the practical concern of political and social organization, of science and technology, and of medicine. It is not the concern of the religious part of our living, except insofar as the religious part of our living will impel us to do the best that we can under the circumstances for the benefit of those who suffer. But time and again, it is impossible to do anything. I remember very well in 1960, towards the end of 1960, when I was traveling from Ceylon into India. And after we crossed by the ferry, the Straits of Mannar, which divide Ceylon and India, Sri Lanka nowadays, Ceylon is called, which divides Sri Lanka and India, the train took me through flooded land. And it was a most pathetic sight to see. There were people standing helplessly, knee-deep in water, because the rain had been so heavy that the entire land was flooded out. The water level was barely 1 foot below the railway lines themselves. And here were people who had to live under those conditions, their little huts swept away by the flood. And looking at that, one felt one's absolute helplessness. What could one do? Mile after mile of this. And it's something which awakes one to the terrible nature of the suffering which people have to go through. So, there is suffering also due to our own drawbacks. The drawbacks in our own nature and character, our own lusts, for example, the lust for sensational pleasure, which is not true happiness. Sensational pleasure just goes away, and then we are left craving for the repetition of that pleasure. But there is a true happiness in everyday terms. The happiness that nature itself gives to us, the happiness that comes naturally by itself when you step out of your front door into a lovely starlit night, you get a thrill of happiness. You haven't asked for it, you haven't desired it, you haven't competed with anybody for it, and there it is, given by nature to you. And that sort of happiness is constantly present, constantly available in our everyday life, but we have been not sufficiently well brought up, or educated to be able to recognize that that is the true sensational physical happiness which is something worth having. It inspires one. there is no feeling of possessing that. You can't possess the starlit nights. You can't possess the beautiful sunsets or the incredibly lovely dawn. And because you can't possess it and it is universal, therefore it gives you a taste of that eternal happiness which the heart of man inwardly longs for. That pleasure is right and it is necessary, because without the right sort of pleasure in life, the pleasure of good food, for example, not because you have hankered for it, but because it is there, it is good food, it is well prepared, and you enjoy it. And that is good for oneself, and good for health, and so forth. That sort of happiness is legitimate happiness. The happiness of children and your loved ones, the happiness of family life, the happiness of friendship, true friendship, all these things are true happiness. Then there is the suffering due to our fears, our hates, our anxieties, our jealousies, and the suffering brought about by our ambitions, which makes us compete with everybody else, makes us try to go one better than the other, break records and what not. It gives a temporary pleasure, but it exalts ego and vanity. And ego and vanity do not spell the true happiness of life. Now, in addition to all that, there is another meaning of suffering, another meaning which is of the utmost importance for understanding how man's urge towards eternal happiness can find its proper expression. When a person tries to live the religious life in the true sense, not merely the external, not merely in terms of all the external forms, but the inward religious living, which means living in such a manner that there is a constant purification of one's nature going on, there comes the point when one is intensely aware that one is not in union with the transcendent. One is separate from transcendence. And that causes an inner sorrow which we must not try to get rid of, far from it. We must cherish that sorrow, because it is that sorrow which supplies the energy, the pure energy which is infinite, which is resistless, and which is all creative. That sorrow moves us to understanding the art of living religiously in the true sense, and the right discipline which is associated with that sort of living. And in this discipline, the most important force at work is meditation. Meditation is a word which is very much misunderstood, and the actual state of meditation is not clearly seen. But with this subject, which is the profound concern of religious living, you can use the word meditation, or you can use the term contemplative prayer. And this, which is the profoundest concern of religious living, we'll deal with tomorrow. Thank you. The word for suffering, for the ill state in Sanskrit is dukkha, and for happiness in the profound sense is sukha. Kham or kha means the infinite. It means the transcendent, that which is not measurable, that which has no limitations whatsoever, which is the utterly free. Kha. And the word du means spoilt or bad. So the meaning of sorrow in this profound religious sense is being far from the infinite, not united with transcendence, broken away from the one total reality. And that is the supreme suffering that individuals can undergo. Of course, not all individuals will undergo this, because all individuals are not sufficiently interested in these matters. Sukha, su means happy. We have words like sugata, which means he who has progressed happily, come to supreme fulfillment, sugata. And this is the term which is applied to the perfected holy ones who have lived in the world through the ages, and some of whom are alive even today. So now this is the profoundest concern of religion, to be free of this separation from transcendence, to be alone in the wrong sense of the term alone. The right sense of the term alone is the one only. There is only the one total reality, the unitary wholeness of all existence. When we are unaware of it, we are unconscious of it, when we do not live continuously in the state where we are aware of this one total reality, then we are in a state of dukkha. And the state of sukha is the where this state has been transcended, and there is the union with the divine.